The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So today I want to speak to you about the correlation of the inner serenity and the outer serenity as a natural outcome of our practice of quieting the mind. Many of us feel the desire to also have an environment around us that reflects and supports serenity. As part of the seven factors of enlightenment, we are asked to cultivate cleanliness. And as part of this cleanliness, we talk about the internal and the external basis. The internal base refers to the body, the external to our environment. Last week, I was teaching a group of minor offenders that just completed a jail sentence. They were meditating for the first time. It's very new to them. And an elderly man, after the meditation, expressed in a very simple way what he had felt. He said, "Not only was it pleasant, but I felt clean." I was very touched by that, because think about what it would mean for somebody who has the stigma of a jail sentence and to touch into the possibility of feeling clean. So this is one of the many beautiful gifts that this practice gives us, this sense of inner and outer cleanliness or purity. And when I say outer, is that, as I mentioned before, you naturally want to create an environment in which you live that reflects that that inner state that we cultivate in meditation. The Burmese monk and teacher Upandita explains that part of cultivating the second factor of enlightenment is, as he puts it, keeping the internal base or body clean, which means, of course, bathing regularly, keeping hair and nails well groomed, and making sure, think about this, even this is mentioned in the teachings, the bowels free of constipation. Keeping the external base clean means wearing clean, neat clothes and sweeping, dusting, and tidying your living quarters. This helps the mind become bright and clear. When the eyes fall upon dirt and untidiness, mental confusion tends to arise. But if an environment is clean, the mind becomes bright and clear. This mental state is ideally conducive to the development of wisdom. So we might think that it's not so important what the kind of environment we create, but the intention that I have set myself with this talk is to convey the centrality, the way that it supports us, and certainly from my own experience, I hope to communicate the well-being that it offers when you get this deep understanding of correlation, and also joy. It gives a lot of joy when you manifest this mind state that we cultivate in meditation. I think we have a particular challenge in the U.S. Of amassing too many possessions. We come by stuff so easily. And I think that if we want to really externalize the simplicity of mind and living accordingly, that we want to weave into our practice the regular practice of decluttering our space. Now, this is easily said, but it's very difficult to do this. A lot of emotions come up when we have to let go. And this is exactly one I want to look at, this difficulty of letting go. And I want to look at it through the context of the five hindrances. Is any of you familiar with the five hindrances? Yes. Do you remember what they are? No. Okay. Well, yes? Want to say? Yes. Excellent. Restlessness and worry is one. Essential desire is the first one. And then comes ill will or aversion. Then comes sloth and torpor. Then comes, as you said, worry or restlessness. And the last one is doubt. So this little simple list in a very succinct way captures practically all the afflicting mind states. One or the other, somehow you can boil down to one of these five. We know that when these mind states are present, they get in the way of us being able to quiet our mind when we meditate. So it's a very lovely practice when we sit down to meditate and you notice that the mind is hopping here and there, just to very gently, without judging, ask yourself, is there sensual desire right now? Is there ill will or aversion right now? Is there sloth or torpor? Is there worry or restlessness? Or is there doubt? And sometimes we have not only one, but several of them going on at the same time. I like to also think about the order that these lists appear. They always have some wisdom to them. When there's sensual desire, there's the wanting, right? There's the I want, the ill will, I don't want. The sloth and torpor is like you're collapsed into yourself. It's like no energy whatsoever. When there is restlessness and anxiety, the energy is completely all over the place. You know, it's like disorganized. You can't quiet the mind. And when there's doubt, it's like you're straddling the fence. You can't, neither one way nor the other. Also like to think about the bodily expression of the five hindrances. In fact, without my telling you, I want you to close your eyes and just envision how does sensual desire feel in the body. When there is sensual desire, what happens to the body? When there is ill will or aversion, what happens in the body? You can look at the posture, the muscle tone. When there is sloth and torpor, how does the body feel? When there's restlessness and worry, and when there's doubt, thank you. I like to bring this felt sense to the hindrances because, one, you're likely to remember, and two, it's just so informative. They each have a very felt sense in the body, and notice when I was giving you the list, I did this, I've noticed many times in meditation, when there's sensual desire, your body is usually leaning forward. This is not very comfortable to stay like this. When you don't want something, you're leaning back, and so on. And, you know, sloth and torpor, you're collapsed. So either way, you lose the fine balance of being completely aligned within your center axis of your body. So having a quiet mind, a spacious, quiet, clear mind, immediately to me suggests the image of this beautifully aligned hips, torso, shoulders, neck, and head. There's a real correlation there. So slowly, with practice, we learn to make precise and small adjustments to our posture. And this is amazing what it does to this inner-outer wisdom. It almost seems like until we have refined the mind enough, we are able to make the adjustment small and precise enough to really make a difference. Some of you who've done yoga maybe have a bit of an experience with that. Usually the mind is unsteady or coarse enough that our adjustments are very coarse. So if we notice, for example, that we're leaning forward because we're meditating and there's sensual desire, we notice and we go, and it's such an abrupt, brutal shift to the body that we miss where is the exactly centered spot. So when we sit down to meditate, we are creating the conditions for equanimity, clarity, stillness. And this is very pleasant when they do arise. They not always arise, right? We know that. But when they do arise, they are very pleasant states of mind. However, we want to remember, this was a bit of a surprise for me when I first realized this, we want to remember that these pleasant feelings are not the goal, not the end, right? But the means to further investigate what is it that causes in our lives suffering? Where do we get caught? So we can, yes, we can rest and enjoy the feeling of quietude, but then also, okay, now let's investigate. Where do I get caught? So as part of creating favorable conditions for our practice, we create a serene, clutter-free, and clean environment. So some of what I'm going to say, it's going to be things that you know, but I think that it's still useful to hear it within the context of the practice and to notice how you hear it. For example, asking the obvious, what is clutter? Clutter is whatever we don't use anymore. We don't appreciate. It's in disrepair. It's in disarray. Or we have too much of in a small space. That's what constitutes clutter. So when we look at the correlation of clutter and what happens in our bodies and in our minds, from readings and my own experience, I've concluded that there are very specific physical effects that are common when living with clutter. And this is nasal congestion, allergies due to dust, interestingly enough, constipation, and often is correlated, I'm not saying always, but often is correlated with problems with weight. Now, also there are specific psychological conditions that come with it. And these are confusion, indecision, procrastination, tiredness, and depression. So when I speak of creating a clutter-free environment, of course, I don't mean perfection. What we want to do is just create a space free of confusion, of what drains our energy, and that which devours the sense of spaciousness. I like to think of setting the intention that we only keep that which has a purpose and value for us. So, one of my jobs in the last few years, which has kind of emerged in a very natural and surprising way, has been to support people to declutter their homes as a spiritual practice. And to do that, I've noticed that it's very important to allow a space to embrace the emotions that come up in this process. So I've noticed that two very important things happen when you create areas that are spacious and clean and free of clutter. We strengthen the ability to let go, you know, it's like a muscle. We let go, we practice in things that are not so difficult, and then maybe we can practice. We are able to be a little bit more skilled at letting go of more difficult, in more difficult areas, like letting go of a loved one. And then we're creating the other wonderful gift that happens is that we're creating an environment that reflects and supports the inner stillness and peace and clarity that we're cultivating in our minds. So those are the two things that we get as gifts as we do this. In the Buddhist teachings, disciplining the mind is often compared to refining gold. And you do that by removing the impurities of gold so that it can be malleable. I would say that the equivalent of the impurities in the mind are the five hindrances. And the equivalent of the five hindrances in our environment is all that stuff that we don't need anymore. So let us now go through the five hindrances one at a time to investigate how they relate to this topic. So central desire involves all the senses, our five senses. And from the five hindrances, it says that is the one that has the most power over us. In the teachings, we're told that when we are under sensual desire, we perceive everything as if seen through a particular lens that is colored. The image that that the Dharma actually provides is a bowl with water, and the water is dyed of some color. So everything that you look is through this particular color. Yeah. So when we are under sensual desire, under the grips of sensual desire, when it comes to accumulating, it's very hard to see clear. You know, we want many beautiful and pleasurable things to see, to smell, to taste, to touch. And that is fine. Remember, we're not ascetics. It's okay. The teachings say, go ahead and enjoy them. Enjoy them deeply. But don't get attached to them. Let them go when it's time. And don't accumulate too much that it starts to strangle your space. So I like to set the intention as far as possessions or acquiring something that We enjoy it, we care for it, we don't get attached to it, and we let it go when it comes time, when its time comes to let go. So in one of the numerical discourses, there is one called the Four Kinds of Happiness. And I'll read to you what it says about lay people and being able, this particular, one of the four happiness is called happiness of possessions for lay people. And it says, "In what householder is the happiness of possession? Here, a family man possesses wealth acquired by energetic striving, amassed by the strength of his arms, earned by the sweat of his brow, righteous wealth righteously gained. When he thinks, 'I possess wealth acquired by energetic striving, amassed by the strength of my arms, earned by the sweat of my brow, wealth righteously gained,' he experiences happiness and joy. This is called the happiness of possession." It's kind of nice, right? It's a, you know, there is a certain happiness that we lay people experience of having things, especially if we came by them in an ethical way. In the teachings, we not only are presented with the perils that come with the hindrances, but also we are offered the antidote. You know, what can we cultivate to counteract? For example, sensual desire is unifying the mind. And if you think about it, it's a wonderful, wise antidote. Do you remember the story of the Buddha when, in the night of his enlightenment, when he's about to be enlightened and Mara appears to seduce him? And the Buddha is already so concentrated, calm, his mind so unified, which in its way offers tremendous sense of delight. If you've ever experienced a unified mind, it's one of the most exquisite pleasures. In that state, sensual desire doesn't have power to seduce you. So that's why it's so interesting to cultivate. When you cultivate a unified mind, you have a bigger joy, a bigger pleasure. So that was sensual desire. Now, ill will or aversion. The image that the Dharma gives us for ill will or aversion is again the bowl of water, but this time the water is boiling. So if you try to see your image in a boiling water, it's impossible. When there is aversion, we don't want to accept reality as it is. And one of the ways that it could get expressed in the topic that we are talking about is, for example, not accepting that our body has changed and that the clothes that we have hanging in our closet don't fit anymore. And we just continue to accumulate these clothes. Some years ago, somebody here at IMC organized a Buddhist Halloween party. And the idea was that you were supposed to come dressed as a ghost. And this ghost was supposed to embody something that you were ready to let go. Now, a friend of mine had a wonderful idea. She came dressed with the tightest jeans that you can believe it. The button was here and the buttonhole was here. She couldn't pull up the zipper. And a t-shirt that was really strangling her that came up to here. She told us all that these were clothes that she loved, that brought wonderful memories, that she wore when she was in college. We're talking about 30 years ago. And she said, "But I have taken this party as an invitation, as an opportunity to embrace the reality that my body has changed, that I don't fit in these clothes anymore, and that I'm ready to let go of this fantasy that one of these days I will fit into these clothes." So I thought, wow, that takes a lot of chutzpah. No, don't you think? To come dressed like that We all laughed with her in a very sweet way, because we all said, oh, you know, I too have some of those antiques in my closet that I'm not quite ready to let go. And what's really wonderful is that the antidote for for this hindrance is delight. And delight arose naturally when we were sharing with her ability to let go of this attachment to these clothes. So now let's go to the third hindrance, sloth and torpor. So the image here that we're provided is again the bowl with water, but the water has algae. So that suggests to me this heaviness, this lack of energy. So the messy environment is not only bad for our health, but is because it's, you know, we know it's very difficult to clean, and then it ends up harming our respiratory, and we have problems with allergy. But the problem is that it also drains our energy when we have that kind of environment. So it's a challenge when we are under sloth and torpor. There is this resistance already, because we're feeling sloth and torpor, to do something about our environment. And the environment itself is draining our energy. So it's very difficult to break this vicious circle. I think just knowing that that's what happens helps us. The antidote to sloth and torpor is aiming purpose directionality. So having the clarity of how it functions with us, I think, can help us break that vicious circle. We go to now the fourth hindrance, restlessness and worry. Restlessness and worry is often at the center of accumulating, because we are afraid we're not going to have enough. So we're constantly living in fear. We accumulate stuff a lot from the mind state, just in case. You know, just in case. So we're afraid we're not going to have what we need and when we need it. A lot of anxiety also can come up when we just even consider letting go of something. So find it useful to remind ourselves that we really are a temporary guardians of whatever we own. The image provided, again, in the Dharma for restlessness and worry is a bowl with water, and the surface of the water is whipped by the wind. So in the same way, our minds, when worry, we're churning constantly these worrisome scenarios, right, that in itself create more worrisome scenarios, as maybe you know already this wonderful quote from Mark Twain that says, "My life consists of a series of disasters that never took place." And that to me really sums up what we do with restlessness and worry. I get the idea when we of an anthropological dig, when we go at it and go digging into our things, and it says as we go deeper and deeper, we get to layers upon layers of memories and emotions. I'll share with you an example that I came across in my work with a woman that had to contend with guilt as we came to work in a particular area of her house. She had one refrigerator specifically designated to store bags and bags and bags of gluten-free flour. That's all she had in one refrigerator. One of the things that I have learned in this work is that you do not jump into value judgments. You wait to see what is behind this accumulation. Years ago, when you could not buy gluten-free bread, her husband developed a sensitivity to wheat. So as a dutiful wife, she bought this flour. She was convinced she was going to bake bread. But when it came down to it, she really didn't want to bake bread. So unable to embrace this truth of hers, she would go back to the store. And at the store, she would convince herself she was going to bake the bread and would buy some more. So we do this constantly with ourselves, right? That we don't want to see our truth, and we coerce ourselves into being somebody we're not quite. And so we are in conflict with ourselves. And there she was, you know, struggling with this tremendous sense of guilt that she wasn't baking the bread. And from the feeling of guilt, she would buy more flour. When I started to work with her, her husband had been dead for a couple of years. And there was still this monstrous refrigerator full of flour. Now, when we began to talk about it, I mean, we really had to make space to embrace the feelings, first of grief that her husband was gone. We came across that many times. Then of appreciating her intention. Her intention was really noble. Appreciating all she had done for her husband, not only focusing on what she hadn't done. She really was an amazingly caring wife. She did a lot for him. So acknowledging those feelings, acknowledging everything that she had done for him. And then offering herself forgiveness, accepting that there was a limit, that baking the bread was something she could not offer joyfully. That was the limit. Yeah? Bring acceptance to that. So once that happened, there was so much lightness and joy in the process of throwing out these bags. Both of us were laughing as we were walking to the trash cans with our bags and bags of flour. So, again, here I found in a very natural way the antidote that the Dharma gives us for restlessness and worry. It is joy and delight. It's just arose very naturally. And we get to the last one, to doubt. Here, we not only have the bowl with water, but the bowl with water is in a dark place, and the water is muddy. Yes. So, the muddy water is, you know, very suggestive of this thick, is dense, so it's suggestive of this lack of energy. And the darkness, of course, is the lack of clarity. So a cluttered place reinforces confusion and doubt. A very evolved practitioner can surely live in a place that is very messy and still maintain a clear mind. But most of us would suffer and would suffer from confusion in this kind of environment. So again, as with sloth and torpor, we need a very strong intention to get us out of not only low energy, but also confusion that this environment creates. The antidote that we are given for doubt is sustained attention. And translated to this process of decluttering, I've seen it often, is when you are going through your things, the sustained attention means if you pick up an object, do not put it down until you've decided what you're going to do with it. Are you going to recycle it? Are you going to sell it? Are you going to donate it? You decide, you put it down. So to finish, I just want to offer a few general ideas on this topic. I'd like to think that we can set the intention that the joy of acquiring and the joy that, well, I should word it a little bit different, that not only do we experience joy in acquiring, but also joy in letting go. Yeah? Also keeping only a few mementos that are valuable to us will help us not to get so trapped in the past. That's also a very valuable thing. When we only keep a few mementos, not only do we liberate ourselves from the past, but we live a bit more in the present, and we open up space for something new to emerge. We also develop faith that the world will provide what we need and when we need it. This is a lovely quality. If we establish a discerning habit of only keeping that which has meaning for us, what's really wonderful is that we begin to see that this discerning ability starts to spread to other areas of our lives. And very soon we see that we're being more discerning in what we see, what we eat, how we spend our time, who do we spend our time with, what friendships do we keep. So, in other words, we are manifesting in our lives the understanding of the interconnection of the inner and the outer reality. So, when our mind is supported by a serene environment and is free of the five hindrances, it is like looking on the surface of a calm, pristine lake that reflects our image. We can see clearly, and we can also see deeply. So, let's just have a minute of quiet, and maybe we can shift to discussion afterwards. Okay, so if anybody has a comment, a question, if you press the button, does it turn green?
Yeah. It's a brave topic. It was really uncomfortable for me listening to it.
Really?
Yeah, a lot of my clutter, too, is from my parents, so, you know, all of it's meaningful, and there's just tons of little teeny things. And just a lot of what you said hit home. You know, when I pick up one thing, it's I have memories and it has meaning, and then a lot of times I don't want to face and deal with it, so I put it back. It's like you said, I didn't decide, and kind of keep doing it, and it's really been on my mind lately, like this big unfinished thing. So,
you know, first I want to to bow to you for the courage to, first of all, to stick around to hear the talk, because it is, I think, it makes some people uncomfortable, and it's not a very common topic that we bring up in Dharma circles, but it is so much a part of our lives. I mean, I'm very much intrigued to bring the Dharma to as much of our practical life as possible, of our daily life. And there is a tremendous amount of emotion connected with what we keep. And we do have to bring a lot of gentleness to the process, you know, not to beat ourselves up, because sometimes we do this in layers. That's the other thing I've learned working with people, is that, okay, the first time around, maybe you can just let go this much. Okay, it's enough. You know, we don't beat ourselves up. And maybe a year later, you go back and do a little bit more. So really bringing the practice into the process, being gentle with it, being kind with yourself, being patient. It's very, very informing to bring the mindfulness to maybe just do one drawer, the easiest one that's for you, maybe your socks. Well, you get rid of the socks that don't have a pair anymore. And you congratulate yourself when you're done with the drawer. Wonderful. Done. I can do it. Let some time go by until you naturally the strength, the energy, the inspiration comes to tackle something else. Thank you for sharing that. Anyone else?
Can I add, since no one else is?
Yes, of course.
Chiming in? But part of it for me is, maybe it is the letting go. I was going to say it's not so much the letting go, but where is this thing going to go that probably has no meaning to anyone but us kids? You know, it's like just something personal of my dad's a paper, or, you know, his hole in one golf ball, or you just, and there's so many things like that, and it, just to throw them away is like, oh my God, you know, it's somebody's life. It's weird.
Yeah. You know, one of the very wonderful discoveries we make in this practice is the overlay of stories to the experience, or to whatever happens. It's like that overlay that you see of clouds when you're driving the 280 towards Pacifica. You know, there are the mountains, and then there's this overlay of something that can completely change the whole overview. And it's true. I mean, something that has tremendous meaning to you, for somebody else, it was completely nothing. So we can ask ourselves several questions when taking decisions like this. In most of the case, I mean, we can ask, is it useful? Yeah, but this thing is not necessarily useful. It's more like an emotional connection. If you feel that you have too much in the space you have, and that in some ways is pulling you down, keeping yourself maybe too much living in the past, one wonderful thing to do is take photographs of the objects that have meaning to you, and then let go of them. Have a little ritual That's another lovely way of doing. Put together some of the things that have a meaning to you about your parents. Celebrate your parents' life. Thank them. Take a photo of the object. And then let go in whatever way is most meaningful to you. You know, to take it to a shelter or whatever. Now, it takes time, and it takes time and energy. So you have to wait when it's the right time to do it. But I totally understand you. I inherited closets full of clothing from my mother that she adored, and it was hard for me to deal with that. But it helped to give it out to many friends and see that all these people were going to enjoy it and remember her. And little by little, the things that I kept, I've been able to let go, especially if I'm not using them. It's like, okay, you know, I can remember my mom in other ways. I can let go of this. And to keep a few things, it's fine. But just you know, bringing the awareness of, am I paying a price for it? That's the question. Thank you. You're welcome. So, any more questions? Okay, well, it's been a pleasure to be here with you. Have a good week.